Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mongrel Mage by L. E. Modisett, Jr. Narrated by Kirby Hayborn. 1. As Beltor walked along the stone walk on the south side of the causeway, extending from the gates to the city, he glanced down at young Scanlan walking beside him, half wishing he hadn't needed to bring the boy with him. But there was no help for that, not if he wanted to keep the brunette he was seeking from spoiling too soon. Satisfied that the 10-year-old was having no trouble keeping pace, Beltor studied the low-lying fields that stretched almost a kay eastward from the main gates of Fenard before reaching the outer walls. Supposedly, the water gates in the outer walls and levees could be opened to allow the river, such as it was, to flood the fields, making them impassable to an armed force. The only problem, reflected Beltor, was that much of the time the Anard River was little more than a stream, unlike the River Galos, into which it flowed all too many kays to the northeast. He'd never quite understood how a cubit or two of water over the paved causeway in the fields would be much of a deterrent to a determined army, but then no one had asked him, and it was unlikely anyone who mattered would, or that they'd listen to a third-rate mage. In the meantime, he needed to see if he could find enough Burnett, just because Salser hadn't gathered enough before he'd left, and there was no one else to gather it. Not that the great white mage Carold could be bothered, nor even Sidon. Belter swallowed his resentment. If he dared to do otherwise, especially given that Carolt was not only a powerful mage, but also his uncle, and the only one standing between Beltor and his possible conscription as a battle mage for the prefect's army. The very fact that the prefect needed so much Burnett meant trouble, since his principal use for it was as the main ingredient in a balm used to stop blood loss, and stockpiling the ingredients for that balm was a good indication that someone anticipated significant losses of blood. As for Carolt getting the Burnett himself, well, if Beltor were to be fair, he had to admit that it wouldn't have been the best idea to let his uncle or even Sidon anywhere near herbs, given that they both carried so much chaos that their touch would wilt the herbs largely to uselessness. But then, while yours has much less chaos, you still carry enough to spoil the herbs. It would just take longer, Beltor knew, which was why Scanlan was accompanying him to the old herbalist's gardens. Beltor took a deep breath and kept walking, thinking of the old rhyme. Blood from the blade, screams in the night, bind him with Burnett in dark or in light, so blood doesn't flow and order won't go. Although it was early morning, with the sun barely above the low rolling hills farther to the east, Beltor had not only to squint against the light, but to blot his forehead. The summer day was going to be hot, as were most of the days leading to harvest, and the stillness of the air made it seem even warmer than it was. He had no doubt that he'd be soaked through with sweat by the time he and Scanlan returned, since Arilla's cottage and gardens were more than a cave from the nearest gate in the outer walls.
"Why couldn't we have hired a cart, sir?" asked Scanlan.
"Carts and horses cost silvers. Walking doesn't. If you want your coppers, don't complain."
"Yes, sir."
Scanlan shifted the empty cloth bag from one shoulder to the other. Roughly a half-glass later, after walking from the outer gates along the wall, Beltor rapped on the weathered door of the small cottage, whose gardens spread behind it under the old outer wall of Fenard. The gardens contained no trees. By edict of the prefect, no trees were permitted within half a kay of the wall, despite the fact that all that lay between the outer walls and the city walls were fields and pastures. The door opened, and a wiry woman stood there, wearing brown trousers and a patched brown tunic. Beneath short brown hair strewn with occasional gray, black eyes focused skeptically on Beltor,
looking up at him just slightly, not exactly a surprise, because Beltur was somewhat on the short side and more than a head shorter than his uncle.
"Good morning, Arilla,"
offered Beltur with a cheer he did not entirely feel. Arilla looked sourly at Beltur, then at Scanlan. She shook her head.
"Bryn or Burnett?"
"Burnett."
"Makes no sense to me why Prefect Denadra put a white mage in charge of making balms."
"You know as well as I do, Arilla, because the few healers in Fenard wouldn't.
You won't do it either."
"I could, but knowing why he wants it, I won't sleep for days."
She stepped back and motioned for the two to enter the cottage, then closed the door behind them, turning and walking toward a narrow doorway at the rear of the cottage.
"That doesn't make sense to me," Beltur replied. "You aren't even a healer. Besides, how can making something that can save a man's life be chaotic?"
Arilla stopped, her hand on the latch to the rear door.
"War is chaos, especially if you don't have to fight. It's not like the Marshal or the Tyrant are ever going to attack Galos, or even the Viscount, for all his talk. As for those traders from Spidlar, they hate war. Bad for trade, they say. Anyway, I've only got enough left for one bag."
"You have more than that," pressed Beltur.
"I do. You take that, and there won't be any come next summer."
He could sense the truth of her words, and that meant Geralt wouldn't be happy. But then, his uncle was seldom happy, and when he was, it wasn't for long, or so it seemed to Beltur.
"You have a bag for me to put the leaves in?"
Scanlan, give her the bag.
"You haven't touched the bag, have you, Beltur?"
"No, and it hasn't been near Geralt either."
"That'd be some small help. Wait here."
She paused after opening the door.
"And I'd thank you not to touch anything."
Then she stepped outside, leaving the door half open. As he waited, Beltur was glad they were inside, because the cottage was cooler than outside, if not by much, and they were out of the sun.
"She never lets us go with her," said Scanlan.
"No, herbalists are like that."
Except Beltur knew that Arilla had no problem with Scanlan, just with Beltur. She was protective of her plants and bushes. He couldn't blame her.
"Bryn costs more, doesn't it?"
"Usually."
"Why doesn't Mage Geralt want more of it?"
"It's not what he wants. It's what the Prefect wants."
And Burnett was easier to grow or find than Bryn, and a great deal less expensive.
"The Prefect most likely has all the Bryn he needs. Enough for his officers, at least."
Scanlan did not ask any more questions. Beltur waited and watched as Arilla cut the Burnett, easing the long leaves with their ragged-looking edges into the bag. Despite her deft movements, the weight seemed to stretch into what seemed to be almost a glass, but was undoubtedly only a fraction of that, before Beltur could see Arilla returning. He stood back as the herbalist re-entered the cottage and closed the rear door. She handed the bag, seemingly slightly more than half full, to Scanlan, then looked to Beltur.
"Half a silver, and a bargain at that. You got more than half a bag."
Beltur extended the 5 coppers.
"Thank you."
"Still doesn't make any sense to me,"
murmured the herbalist, shaking her head, then adding in a louder voice,
"You'd best be on your way. It won't get any cooler if you wait."
In moments, Beltur and Scanlan were walking back along the dusty road that paralleled the outer wall, puffs of dust rising from the mage's white boots with each step he took. He was careful to keep enough distance from Scanlan so that he wouldn't inadvertently brush the bag of Burnett. The last thing he wanted was for anything to happen to the Burnett, because his uncle would immediately blame him. When the two of them reached the open gates of the outer wall,
One of the guards in the black uniform and leathers of Galos looked at Beltur.
"What's in the bag, mage?"
"Burnett. It's an herb for healing." When the guard looked skeptical, Beltur said to Scanlan, "Open the bag a little and show the guard."
"Don't bother."
The other guard frowned.
"Why the boy? The bag's not that heavy."
"Chaos wilts the herbs, and they won't stop the bleeding as well." The second guard waved them through. The causeway was even hotter than the road outside the walls had been, and Beltur blotted his forehead again. He hated to think what the city proper would be like by late afternoon. Unlike the guards at the outer gates, neither of the two at the inner gates gave more than a glance to Beltur and Scanlan, perhaps because they were more interested in a peddler in his cart and the young woman with him. Once inside the walls, Beltur glanced up at the clear greenish-blue sky, then dropped his eyes to the ancient stones of the old city wall, a wall that supposedly dated back to the time of Fenardra the Great. Certainly, he could sense the age, with the random chaos that coated the old ordered stone blocks of the wall. With a small sigh, he turned his steps toward the great square, well beyond which was the stone dwelling he shared with his uncle in Sidon, Carol's main assistant, and also a much stronger mage than Beltur. Then he adjusted his heavy off-white tunic, almost wishing that he didn't have to wear it, because of the early heat of the day, and because it led people to think that he was a more powerful mage than he really was, as opposed to the weak white wizard he was, who can sense and use a small amount of order as well. Then again, the white tunic did mean that he was less likely to be the victim of a cutpurse or other less savory types. From somewhere drifted the acridness of burning wood and the more enticing aroma of fowl roasting. For a moment, he thought that it was too early for that, except it was already mid-morning, and whoever was roasting the bird or birds wanted to have them ready by noon. Beltur could feel his entire body tightening the way he felt when there was a concentration of chaos somewhere nearby. He kept walking, slowly looking across the great square, taking in the various peddlers in their carts and stalls. His eyes paused at a stall that featured all manner of blades, and mainly knives, but he realized that was because one of the older blades, an ancient cupridium short sword of some sort, seemed to contain chaos. For use against order mages? Pushing that thought aside, he kept searching, both with his eyes and senses, past a vendor with a rack of scarves, whose voice carried across the square.
"The finest in Hamorian shimmer silk scarves, all the way from Sigawern, the very finest!"
"Perhaps the finest since the vanished silks of Syad, if that," murmured Beltur to himself as he continued to seek out the source of chaos, his eyes going beyond the silks peddler to a heavy-set man with a cart piled high with melons of at least two types, who was so ordered that he couldn't possibly be the source of the chaos. Nor would a mage with that much chaos be comfortable for long near the grower. Beltur glanced back over his shoulder and saw no one, but he could definitely sense the chaos several yards behind him, which meant that the mage was holding a concealment. The unseen mage was also fairly close. Wondering whether the mage was just moving across the square without wanting to be seen, or if he just might possibly be following them, although Beltur couldn't imagine why anyone that powerful would follow him, he said to Scanlan, "This way," and then turned to his right, away from the scarf vendor, and between the stall with the knives and another stall where a wizened woman in gray was setting out cloth bags that looked to be herbal or fragrant sachets, not that Beltur could smell the fragrances amid the heavier odors of fowl and bodies. Scanlan glared at Beltur for a moment, but kept pace with the mage. After passing several rows of vendors, Beltur changed direction again, back toward the north side of the square,
and the side street that would lead to the old stone dwelling where he studied and lived under Carol's sufferance, and largely did his uncle's bidding. Unhappily, the concealed Chaos Mage remained behind him, if slighter farther back, but still fairly close. That wasn't surprising, given that Beltur was a weak wight who didn't hold that much free chaos near him, and most whites sought out chaos in sensing, possibly because many strong whites were practically order-blind. Given the power and the amount of chaos Beltur sensed around the other, there really wasn't too much else that he could do except continue on, and raise his feeble shields if it appeared that the mage following them was going to attack. Still worrying, Beltur and Scanlan turned onto the street that led home, or the only place Beltur could have called home in the 10 years since his father's death, since Beltur had no other relatives. He tried to stay on the east side, where there was still some shade. The street had no real name, but everyone called it Nothing Lane, because unlike Joiner's Lane, Cooper's Gate, Bagger's Way, or Silver Street, there was no particular shop or occupation represented along its narrow way, among them a small inn with a sign proclaiming it was the Brass Bowl, even though most regulars called the public room the Yellow Bucket, a cloth merchant, a fuller's shop, and a number of narrow dwellings, including that of Carold, although his could have been said to be on Middle Street as well, since it was on the corner of Middle and Nothing. Carold hadn't been pleased the one time that Beltur had referred to its location as Half Nothing. Strangely, after Beltur and Scanlan had gone 2 blocks toward Middle, still 2 blocks from home, the other mage had stopped, then turned back toward the Great Square. Beltur wasn't sure what that meant, but he was glad the man hadn't kept following them. He blotted his forehead again. Even so, sweat was still running down the side of his narrow face and into his eyes. He took a slow, deep breath and kept walking. As the two neared the end of the second block, Beltur found he wasn't sweating as heavily. He was sure the shade helped, but he had been worried about the mage who had been seemingly trailing him. When he reached the heavy oak door, just 1 step above the uneven bricks of the sidewalk, he paused, then took out the heavy brass key and unlocked the door. The lock was heavy and crude, but it kept out casual thieves. Even Beltur could muster enough chaos to take care of those who were less casual, and Carolt never left traces, except ash, of those who were foolish enough to enter. Once inside, he just slid the lock bolt and blotted his forehead again. At least the stone house was cooler than outside, and would remain so until late afternoon, perhaps even longer. He motioned for Scanlan to lead the way to the storeroom, then followed, stopping outside the locked outer door. He used a touch of order to shift the stored chaos from the lock to the sealed cupridium box fastened to the rear of the door, then unlocked the door and opened it, stepping back and turning to the boy.
"You know what to do."
"Yes, sir."
Scanlan stepped forward and opened the second door, revealing the thin sheet of iron attached to the back side, moved forward. Beltur watched from the hallway as Scanlan put the bag on the second shelf, beside several others there, then stepped back and closed the inner door on the small storeroom, the one place in the house that neither Beltur nor Carolt ever entered, unlike the larger storeroom and workspaces farther back in the house. Although the larger storeroom was also locked in the same fashion, a double door was not required. After Beltur closed and locked the outer door to the small storeroom, replacing the chaos, Scanlan looked to Beltur with a trace of a grin.
"Do I get my coppers now?"
"When we get to your house. Not until. The same as always."
"Mother will take them." Scanlan offered a mournful expression. "She always does."
"We'll see."
Beltur hid a smile.
the two made their way from the building that was both dwelling and workplace back out onto Nothing Lane, crossing Middle Street, and hurrying slightly to avoid a dray being driven too fast by a young-looking teamster, before entering the fourth door on the east side of the lane, over which was a signboard of sorts that displayed two baskets, rather the halves of two baskets, because displaying a complete basket would have been an invitation to theft as soon as it was completely dark. In the small room behind the door stood a sturdy dark-haired woman with a worried face, concentrating on weaving osier shoots into a small basket. She looked up.
"We're back, Thorala."
Thorala looked to her son.
"Were you good?"
"He was quite good."
Beltor nodded, then extracted the three coppers from his wallet and handed two of them to Scanlan, keeping the third hidden. In turn, Thorala held out her hand. With a grimace and a sigh, Scanlan handed the coins to his mother.
"Your father needs help with the osier shoots?"
"I'll go with him," said Beltor. "I need to ask Zandil about a basket weave belt."
"He doesn't like to make those."
Thorala shrugged.
"Talk to him if you want."
"It can't hurt."
Beltor managed a rueful smile, then turned to follow Scanlan, who trudged toward the rear workroom. Just before they reached the archway into the workroom, Beltor slipped the last copper into Scanlan's hand, murmuring, "Not a word." The boy managed not to grin, then said to the man at the workbench,
"Ma said you needed me."
"About..."
Zandil broke off his words as he looked up and saw Beltor.
"Didn't know you were here, mage."
"Thorala said you weren't too keen on doing woven belts."
"Basket weave anything for the right price."
"I thought a woven belt might last longer than a leather one."
"It true that new mages are hard on garments?"
"Some are harder than others. How much might a belt cost?"
"Half a silver."
Beltor nodded.
"I'll have to think about it."
"Think too long and it might cost more."
Beltor grinned.
"Can't say that surprises me."
He looked to Scanlan.
"Thank you again."
Then he turned and headed back toward the front room. Thorala barely looked up as he let himself out and began to walk back home. He still couldn't help but wonder why a powerful white mage had been holding a concealment in the great square, and why the man had followed him and Scanlan for two blocks from the square before turning away.
Did he think you were someone else?
Why else would anyone follow a third-rate white mage? Beltor certainly couldn't think of any other reason. In the meantime, he intended to clean up the main workroom, something that Sidon and Carolt felt was beneath them. 2. After cleaning up the workroom, Beltor went to the study, simply because it was the coolest chamber in the house. He couldn't help but pick up the thin volume bound in faded green leather, the Book of Erelin. Carolt had inherited the book from Beltor's father, unlike the books on magery that had come from Goern, the old mage who had mentored his uncle, but his father had never disclosed how he had obtained the druid volume. That was what Carolt claimed, anyway. Beltor settled down in the corner chair and began to leaf through the pages until one section struck him in a way he had not noticed before. "Yet Saren struck the gates with order and chaos, and the gates yielded, and the walls holding them crumbled, and all within perished or were scattered to the winds. Upon the plains outside of Duavec, the city that became Saron, Saren met and destroyed all the white mages sent from Suthia to best her."
"She struck the gates with order and chaos."
Beltor frowned. Despite the fact that the book was a product of druid scriveners, and doubtless not accurate when it came to the depiction of the powers of women, even Carolt had acknowledged that the description of Galassian history
and the treachery of Prefect Arthanos was in fact largely as described in the Book of Erlin, yet Geralt had always stressed that a white mage or any user of chaos needed to keep the use of order to an absolute minimum to avoid weakening the chaos. He was still pondering that when he heard the front door opening. Quickly, he stood and replaced the green-bound volume on the shelf and hurried out of the study and toward the small entry hall to greet his uncle and Sidon. Geralt was tall, broad-shouldered, with blonde hair already silvering and deep-set black eyes that seemed to look right through Beltur when he frowned at his nephew, but he smiled pleasantly as Beltur approached.
"Did you get the Burnett?"
"All that remained, half a bag."
"That's all?"
"Arilla said she wasn't going to destroy her plants to give me an extra half bag."
"She always says something like that," added Sidon, who turned from sliding the lock bolt on the front door.
"She was telling the truth," replied Beltur.
"As she saw it," said Geralt dryly. "That's what is."
"There is something I wanted to talk over," began Beltur.
"That can wait. I need to prepare to leave first thing in the morning."
"For where? Why?"
"Prefect Denardra wants me to do something about the trouble in Analyria, and he's paying well, which is unlike him. It will also bring in some silvers and get us out of Fenard for a while."
"What trouble?" asked Beltur. "I haven't heard about anything to the south. Well, except for the nomad raiders in the southern grasslands. They're always causing trouble, but that's nothing new."
"No, it's not exactly new, but this time it's the result of a recurrence of an old problem. The arms commander in Kyphrian tried to enforce the law against women leaving their families to flee Westwind."
"Kyphrian's not... Oh, and he's in charge of Analyria as well?"
"Brilliant deduction.
If the women don't want to stay, why force them to? They'd only make their families miserable, and whatever poor fellow has to consort them..."
"Women should listen to their men," replied Geralt. "If a lot of them leave, then that makes the men angry, and it's harder to keep the peace. Besides, you know how I feel about the bitches of Westwind. One way or another, they and their legend are always stirring things up."
"There's always some belief somewhere causing trouble," said Beltur, wondering why believers in the legend were any different from the Chaordists or the few remaining believers of the Black Temple. Geralt looked condescendingly at Beltur.
"You really don't understand, do you?"
"What is there to understand?" Beltur wasn't about to say that. "I probably don't." The older mage offered a sound between a sigh and a snort.
"Then let me make it very simple. If the young women and the girls who are about to become women leave, then there are more men than women. The men raid other towns or hamlets for women. The others fight back. Soon everyone is fighting. This requires the prefect to send armsmen to keep the peace. Lots of them, and that costs golds."
"More than hiring poor white mages," thought Beltur.
"In the meantime, because the men are fighting, more women flee to Westwind. Because the Analyrian men have even fewer women, they fight more. The prefect's armsmen have to kill the Analyrian men to stop the fighting. Dead men can't be conscripted, and everyone loses horses, and that costs the prefect more golds."
Geralt looked hard at Beltur.
"Now, do you understand?"
Beltur had understood that much before the explanation.
"Why does he need more men for the army? He's not fighting anyone."
"There are rumors that the Viscount of Syrtis is going to increase tariffs on goods passing through Syrtis. Those rumors are likely to become fact because the Viscount is short of golds."
What about just sending goods down the River Galos to Spidlaria?
The Spidlarian Council is also thinking...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?